From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, redesigning America's high schools. We talk with Ted Sizer. He chairs a coalition of schools putting theories of school reform into practice. Tonight, the PBS program Mystery premieres a new series called Prime Suspect, about a woman recently promoted to Detective Chief Inspector, who is heading up her first murder investigation, facing a lot of resistance from the men in the department. We talk with the British actress Helen Mirren, who stars in the series and also starred in The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Juice. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Intervax News Agency reports that supporters of ousted Georgian President Zviad Gamzakhourdia have agreed to lay down their arms in the western part of the country that they control. There is no immediate confirmation of this report. Interfax quoted an unidentified source on the Georgian Military Council, the loose coalition of dissidents and intellectuals that seized power from Gamzakhourdia. The agreement reportedly came in talks yesterday between the council and the ousted president's supporters. Russian President Boris Yeltsin today announced a series of steps designed to speed up moves toward a market economy. The first was the suspension of all import restrictions, NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
A Russian government resolution says customs tariffs are now suspended, and a new customs schedule will only be drawn up later this spring. President Yeltsin also said he is ready to sign a decree abolishing all state-owned trading monopolies. This decree would allow every citizen or organization to trade at any place and in any goods without government permission. Just what impact this will have on sales of weapons, oil, and strategic minerals is not clear. Yeltsin told the CIS aid conference in Washington he is open to foreign enterprise and that the necessary legal guarantees for investment are being created. Yeltsin thanked the West for its aid, saying it would help ease the pain of transition to a market economy. He promised it would be distributed fairly. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
Israel has rescinded the deportation order of one of 12 Palestinians slated for expulsion from the Israeli-occupied territories. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
It is believed to be only the second time that Israeli authorities have overturned an expulsion order. A military review board recommended that 28-year-old Ayad Jodeh, a student at Birzeit University, be allowed to remain in the West Bank. The board found that Jodeh had no lengthy history of anti-Israel activities, and he is currently being held in administrative detention. The Army's West Bank commander, General Danny Yatom, accepted the recommendation. At the same time, the military board recommended that four other Palestinians from the West Bank be deported. A separate board in Gaza also upheld the orders against seven Gaza Palestinians. The seven have appealed to the Israeli Supreme Court, and their appeal is pending. Israel announced the expulsion orders earlier this month after armed Palestinians shot and killed four Jewish settlers during the previous 2 months. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The Labor Department says that new claims for state unemployment benefits rose by 46,000 for the week ending January 11th to a seasonally adjusted 447,000. The agency said that many states had layoffs in manufacturing and construction. Stocks closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow retreated 29 points to close at 3226.74. This is NPR. The Associated Press reports that there have been 127 significant accidents involving nuclear weapons production at the Washington-Hanford Nuclear Reservation. The AP obtained a report from the U.S. Department of Energy that showed 14 of the accidents were in the most serious category, and the last major accident occurred in 1980. The DOE says the report contains no new public revelations, but it is the first comprehensive look at the scattered accident history of the former plutonium production site. The U.S. Senate today unanimously approved an education bill that eases federal regulation of schools, but does very little to advance the Bush administration's version of school reform. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The Neighborhood Schools Improvement Act is not what President Bush wanted. The president wanted $500 million to create hundreds of so-called break-the-mold schools, one in each congressional district. Instead, Senate Bill 2, sponsored by Senator Edward Kennedy, offers $850 million in block grants to states and allows local school officials to spend as much as 25% of the money on new experimental schools. The Senate version also encourages school choice but limits it to public schools, preventing parents from sending their kids to private or parochial schools at taxpayers' expense. The Bush administration is hoping Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah, can still amend the bill to include an experimental public-private school choice plan. If not, the Secretary of Education, Lamar Alexander, this week said he will recommend that President Bush veto it. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
A poll published by the Detroit Free Press today finds that a majority of American car owners say they will consider buying American to help the stumbling U.S. auto industry. 51% of 607 car owners interviewed said they would consider only domestic cars when they return to the showroom. 44% said they will consider both foreign and domestic models. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of Americans agree that our public school system isn't working, but there's no national program for reform in place. That's in part because there's little agreement on which reforms would be best, and there's no money to implement the reforms anyways. In the meantime, there are a variety of independent programs testing out new models in public education. One of the most highly regarded systems is held together by the Coalition of Essential Schools, a partnership between Brown University and participating high schools. My guest Theodore Sizer chairs the coalition and is a professor at Brown. He's the former dean of the Harvard Graduate School of Education and former headmaster at Phillips Academy. His new book is Horace's School, Redesigning the American High School. Sizer's approach to redesigning high schools responds to some of the frustrations he faced back when he taught in a public school. One of his greatest frustrations was having too many students.
In my second year of teaching, I had 204 kids, and I only got to know in any significant way a fraction of them. And at the end of the year, it was very disarming to realize that I probably had touched the minority in any consequential way. A later frustration was to realize slowly the confusion that the traditional way of presenting a high school curriculum causes in kids. They go from math to physics to history to phys ed. In good schools, each of these planned coherently within the subject, but in no schools planned coherently across subjects. So it was a serious conversation, more or less serious conversation, each for 52 minutes, with the subject changed drastically and the bell rang. It's a recipe for confusion.
Can you give us a sense of what a day in school might be like in one of the schools that you've redesigned?
Well, if we were to visit a typical school in our coalition that's really moved ahead, we would first of all notice there are no bells to ring, or any bells ringing. We would find the school noisier, but the noise would be student voices discussing among themselves and explaining things to teachers rather than teachers' voices lecturing to the kids. If we looked at a daily schedule, we'd find maybe two or three large blocks of time, and how that time being spent decided by the particular team of teachers and the youngsters working together. Which is to say, the high school would look structurally a lot more like an existing good elementary school than like the traditional high school. We would find students, if we listened carefully to the substance of what was being said, we'd find students endlessly asked to explain why they'd come to the conclusions they had come to. We'd find the outline of the curriculum to be very short. Maybe no more than three broadly defined topics or subjects, such as the arts, history and philosophy, and math and science.
Well, let me stop you here.
Mm-hmm.
One of your frustrations as a teacher was that you had too many students, and you couldn't really get to know all of them well, let alone reach them in a meaningful way. So in your redesigned high school, how many students would a teacher have?
Well, in our coalition, the target is no more than 80. In many schools, particularly schools in big cities, the contract ratio is 175 youngsters to one teacher. That is five classes a day of 35 students.
So if you have 80 students, does that mean you have two classes or a lot of classes with a small number of students?
Well, I think that the best way to describe that, first of all, is to precede it with the assertion that the schools in our that are working with us undertake to change these loads for teachers without changing the budget. That is, we don't bring down the student loads by tripling the faculty. Not that that wouldn't be nice, but it's not going to happen. There isn't the money in the system to do it. So if we're not going to significantly change the budget, steps such as the following would have to take place. I'm a social studies teacher, and you are an English teacher, and each of us has 160 youngsters a day coming at us in five different classes. We go to the principal and we say to the principal, give us the same 160 kids. And I will take 80 and you will take 80. And I will teach both English and social studies to these youngsters. And you will teach English and social studies to your 80 youngsters. And I will observe you and set standards for you in social studies with which you're not as familiar as you should be. And you will likewise keep a control on the quality of my English teaching. Now, the compromise I make and you make is we have to teach more broadly English and social studies, and we have to suffer the indignity of a colleague keeping track of us and holding us to a standard. But what we've gained is half as many students, that is 80 rather than 160, and we see those youngsters twice as long each day as then we used to.
Yeah, but let me just point out here, what you've done for me is you've given me half the number of students, which I appreciate, but you've doubled the number of classes I have to prepare and doubled the amount of subject matter that I need to get a handle on. And this includes subject matter that I have no claims to really have any deep comprehension of.
Yes, there's no free lunch. But the evidence is once you get up to speed and really knock the rust off that English minor or that social studies minor that you had in college, the full effect of the change will be brought to bear. And furthermore, what I've just described to you is a long-time practice in originally junior high schools and now middle schools. English and social studies have been merged in a multidisciplinary situation, as often has mathematics and science. Again, the example I've given you is this kind of crude one. In fact, schools that are moving in this direction have to do about three or four other things at once. That is, the teams have to be richer than just two teachers. They may be four or five, and the groups of students somewhat larger, 100, 120. But as I show in the appendix to my new book, you can take a typical school and on a piece of paper rearrange this and show it how it can be done. It's quite easy to do on a piece of paper. The tough part is doing it in the real world where each of us wants to teach only the narrow subject we've been trained in, and we're quite happy to work in isolation. That is not subject to the review and criticism of our peers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Theodore Sizer, and he is a professor at Brown University, where he chairs the Coalition of Essential Schools, and this is a coalition that has redesigned several high schools. His new book is called Horace, a School Redesigning the American High School. Do you think that the system as it is now encourages mediocrity in teaching? And what I mean by that is, teaching is certainly not a prestige job in our society at the moment, certainly not teaching high school. Salaries are, they're certainly livable, but they're not, you're not handsomely rewarded for teaching. And it's an incredibly difficult job, not only because of all the students and of the problems that students can give you, but if you're a good teacher, you have to go home every night and prepare lessons and grade papers and really wrestle in your mind about what you're going to do the next day in class and what grade you're going to give a student, because a lot of this really is very subjective. And if you care, you're going to be awfully busy.
Mm. Well, there are really two ways of viewing your question. As you phrased it at the beginning, it is the way we run school, the way we pursue schooling, force mediocrity? And my answer to that is yes, in a number of ways. That there is this notion that more is better. And the more facts, the more things one can cover, that means the stronger and tougher the curriculum. In fact, by, for instance, having a world history course for 14 and 15-year-olds, where you go from Cleopatra to George Bush in 6 months, trivializes, really mocks serious history and distorts, and thus is mediocre. At the same time, many of the tests which are imposed on the schools, tests that usually, for reasons of tight budgets, are quite flimsy, again, trivialize. They reduce serious questions, questions demanding really thoughtful answers. It reduces them to a kind of dartboard of choosing this option over some other option. The multiple choice, as the kids say, multiple guess kind of education. And the extent to which our teachers and kids and schools are judged on the basis of scores on those pseudo-tests is the extent to which teachers teach to them, thus once again trivializing education. At the same time, you talked about the mediocre incentives that the society gives to strong people to get into teaching and to stay in teaching, whether those be weak salaries or a kind of demeaning attitude where we say they're professionals but we insist they punch time clocks, and where they, in fact, are driven along by rules much as the students are, where the number of minutes actually... God save us, spent in teaching some subject in a classroom is set by some bureaucrat at the state level rather than by a teacher who happens to know the kids. In my experience, very able people are very ready to leave teaching. Not that the salaries are so bad initially, but because the way that the system treats them is so demeaning. It assumes they're mediocre, and in many cases sets up a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Have you taken a different approach to working with inner-city schools than with suburban schools?
No. I think the basic ideas that drive good schooling apply to at a general level, to all kids. What has been striking in our work over the last 8 years is most of the most ambitious schools, the most risk-taking schools, the ones where the progress has been the most pronounced, are schools serving low-income families. And in many ways, what conventional wisdom would say were the most difficult communities, in fact, have moved ahead most ambitiously. And I think the reason for this is those communities, those families in those places, know that the risks of not changing are greater than the risks of trying something new. Where, on the other hand, the majority schools, affluent schools, where the system seems to serve their kids well, that is, they get into their colleges of their choice, which is different than saying they've been given a rigorous education, don't want any change, or they want very little change because they say, in a quite justified way, from their point of view, the system's working for my kids.
My guest is educator and author Ted Sizer. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Theodore Sizer, and he's the author of the new book, Horace, A School Redesigning the American High School. He is the head of the Coalition of Essential Schools at Brown University, which is a coalition that has redesigned several high schools in the area and around the country. There are schools in your area and around the country who have adopted your coalition's approach to curriculum. I was reading an article about the coalition from about a year ago that said that you had struck a bargain with the governors in six states that the governors would, that you would launch 10 schools in each state if the governors would put up funding, waive restrictive regulations, and then run political interference. How, give us your interpretation of this. How does it work in a state when you and the state agree to try out your curriculum in several schools?
Well, for example, in Delaware, the Governor Castle and leaders in the legislature and some leaders in the university and some leaders in the business community agreed to a process which was endorsed by the State Board of Education to give running room in one way or another to those schools which elected on their part to step forward and join the coalition. And furthermore, the state and Kraft General Foods, the lead business in this, provided planning money and training money to those schools that wanted to proceed. And what has evolved in Delaware is a number of schools that have taken advantage both of the running room, that is, waived regulations, and the resources to visit other schools, to do the work, to run their own staff development programs, so that these schools are developing plans now, which in a few years, if you and I visited, we'd find them quite different than they are today. Also in Delaware, with state funds, there have been a couple of veteran educators who have been given full time to work among these schools to bring together like-minded mathematics teachers, for example, and to stimulate the most ambitious plans and to back the most imaginative people. Delaware is not the only state that's taken this kind of supportive and an enabling role. We see it in Arkansas, we see it in New Mexico, in Illinois, in Pennsylvania, and it's a hopeful sign.
You know, I've been both a student, of course, and a teacher very briefly. And as a teacher, I felt, oh, geez, this system is really flawed. I can't function in it. I'd better leave. As a student, I found that the teachers who really meant something to me, who I really walked away feeling transformed by, weren't teachers who had, like, a pedagogical theory of teaching. They were teachers who were kind of passionately committed to the subject matter, knew a lot about it, and made it so interesting because of their interest, knowledge, and passion, that it was almost contagious. And they were interesting speakers, too. They really knew how to put it across. They could tell a good story. They could bring the subject matter to life. It wasn't a boring recitation. It was a really interesting story that you wanted to be in on. I guess I mention this because whenever I hear about a new system for redesigning the schools or a new pedagogical theory, sometimes it just always boils down to me to, well, how good is the teacher going to be? How good a speaker are they going to be? How much are they going to care about their material?
Teaching has been led down a primrose path by people who think it's a science. That is, that teaching is, if we just got the grammar of teaching right, if everybody did their nouns in the same way, if you followed the seven steps, then everything would be just dandy. That's nonsense. Any more than one studies nothing but grammar, grammar, grammar in order to write like John Updike. I mean, good teaching, whether it is telling or provoking or coaching, is an expression of personality. Each one of us, as individuals, puts our particular spin on it, and that's a wonderful thing. And we must look at teaching as both science and art. Sure, there is a lot we can learn about learning. There's a lot that we can sense in how kids are reacting to things, which are observable in patterns. People before us can tell us something about how kids react in general. Not a particular kid, that is always idiosyncratic, but kids in general. But beyond that, it's really our craft, our artistry, our thoughtful application of the best we know through the vehicle of our own personalities. And I think if you and I reflect back on teachers who had really inspired us, we would find them quite different. They inspired us in different ways.
Absolutely.
And that's really, that is an expression of the important individualism and artistry of the craft. Which comes back to the demeaning side, the mediocrity producing side of teaching, to reduce this intensely personal, if very thoughtful act, to a checklist or to a prescribed sequence is simply to smother it.
Let me bring up an impossible to answer question and see what you have to say about it. You know, when you see how so many of the schools are just falling to pieces, you wonder, is it some kind of larger problem in the social fabric that's breaking down, or is it the system within the schools? And is it possible to really reform the schools without really reforming society? But if you wait till society is reformed, well, that's not going to do you any good for your children for today, you know? So do you think it's possible to really make an impact in the schools and in students' attitudes towards going to school and towards learning when a lot of the students going to school are going in you know, abject poverty with violence both in and out of the schools?
Well, sure, you can't reform schools without reforming society and vice versa, but that's a recipe for despair.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of us starts where he or she is at. I happen to be in a high school. You have to find your own niche and work at it. But it is very difficult these days. I mean, I started my teaching career in the 50s, and it's tougher to grow up in America today than it was in the 50s. And, politicians have always lied. But I don't think it is a jaundice on my part to think that the contemporary politicians tolerate misspeaking a little more rapidly than did, for instance, Dwight Eisenhower. The readiness to have the slick 30-second spot, which sends out a message which deliberately distorts, the toleration of that, the glorious and almost humorous ironies of having state lotteries to support education, state lotteries depending either on the mathematical incompetence of the people or on addicts. I mean, anybody who thinks hard about why lotteries work gets pretty depressed. And it's a pretty forlorn society that takes something which depends on ignorance or addiction as a way of supporting the schools. One can go on and on. The neglect of our young people, the fact that a fifth of American children are growing up in poverty, the abuse of children in the media as well as in the street, these things are just horrendous. Now, we teachers can't just wring our hands and curse. We have to say what we believe about the corrupting influence that the society in its mindlessness is inflicting on kids. But then we have to just pull up our socks and move ahead and do what we can within the framework of the school, working with those families.
Educator Ted Sizer, he chairs the Coalition of Essential Schools at Brown University. His new book is Horace's School, Redesigning the American High School. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Police Story Prime Suspect was a huge hit on British TV. Tonight it premieres on the PBS Mystery Series. It stars Helen Mirren as a detective chief inspector, heading up her first murder investigation, facing hostility and resistance from all the men she works with. Mirren also starred in The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. We'll talk with her on Fresh Air. The new movie Juice is about inner-city teenagers who turn to crime to get respect. There have been shootings at several theaters showing the film. Film critic Stephen Schiff separates the message on the screen from the violence in the theaters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Delegates from more than 50 nations and international organizations have agreed on ways to coordinate their aid for the former Soviet republics. NPR's Ted Clark reports on the just-concluded conference held in Washington.
Working groups on food, shelter, medicine, energy, and technical assistance drew up plans of action to cut redundancy and make their assistance more effective. They'll meet next week in Minsk with officials from the former Soviet republics to further refine the plans. In addition, another major donor conference will be held in Portugal within 4 months, and still another will be held in Japan thereafter. At a news conference, Secretary Baker expressed satisfaction with all these plans.
I think it's fair to say that we truly have a global effort.
Secretary Baker also announced details of the U.S. plan to help the former Soviet republics, an effort he called Operation Provide Hope. For example, the U.S. intends to send 54 flights of medical and food shipments starting February 10th, and the U.S. will provide 2,000 farm volunteers to work with farmers in the region. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The government of Estonia has fallen in the wake of dire food and energy shortages. Just a 5 months after winning diplomatic recognition from other nations, the Baltic country last week imposed a state of emergency. In the capital, hot water is being turned off, and stores are running low on supplies of bread, milk, and cheese. Disruption of economic links with the former Soviet Union has left the nation with shortages of fuel and food, which had been bought at subsidized prices. On Capitol Hill, Democrats in Congress are moving to approve a bill that would provide another extension in unemployment benefits. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Last year, there was a protracted battle over extending jobless pay. This year, the measure is expected to be approved quickly. The president has already announced he's in favor of extending benefits. Last year, President Bush first argued the extension wasn't needed. Then he wrangled with Congress about how to pay for the benefits without adding to the deficit. This time, with applications for unemployment benefits continuing to climb and the president's approval ratings continuing to slip, neither side is expecting a partisan battle. House Democrats have offered legislation that would provide 13 extra weeks of benefits beyond the 20-week extension approved last year. The bill would have the president declare an emergency. That would allow the government to borrow the money and add the cost to the deficit. But congressional leaders said today they're willing to negotiate with the White House to find a way of paying for the extra benefits without adding to the deficit. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 29 points to close at 3,226.74 on volume of some 230 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. A Moscow newspaper is reporting that Russia's deputy prosecutor wants to question former Soviet President Gorbachev about money spent on communist parties in other nations. A former member of the Central Committee charged the now-defunct Soviet Communist Party used state instead of party funds to finance overseas communists, and that criminal charges should be brought against those who diverted the money. Several news services are now confirming a report in today's New York Times that President Bush will announce deep new cuts in nuclear weapons in his State of the Union address next Tuesday. Reportedly, the president will make unilateral reductions in missiles with multiple warheads and include submarine-based missiles in the cuts for the first time. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
The biggest and most dangerous missiles carry 10 or more warheads, which can be aimed at different targets, They're called MIRVs, which stands for Multiple Independently Targeted Reentry Vehicles. President Bush proposed the elimination of land-based MIRVs in September, but there was little incentive for the Soviets to take him up on the offer, since most of their MIRVs would be eliminated, while most of the U.S. force wouldn't be affected, since the U.S. keeps most of its MIRVs at sea on submarine-based missiles. Reportedly, the president plans to sweeten his offer by including submarine-launched missiles as part of the package. He's also expected to propose strategic arms cuts well below the ceilings allowed under the START Treaty, some unilateral, others dependent on reciprocal cuts in old Soviet weapons based in Russia, Kazakhstan, Belarus, and Ukraine. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
The government says that the nation's budget deficit was down to $2.64 billion in December, a drop of 94% from the month before. The Treasury Department says that the nation's deficit for 1992 is expected to be about $350 billion. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The police drama Prime Suspect was a big hit on British television. Tonight, the three-part series premieres on the PBS Mystery Program. It stars Helen Mirren, a veteran of the Royal Shakespeare Company and the star of the originally X-rated film The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. Prime Suspect is a little more gritty than the average British mystery import. Mirren plays Jane Tennyson, recently promoted to Detective Chief Inspector. After 18 months on the job, she hasn't yet been assigned a murder case. A sex crime has just been reported, and the detective on the case has died of a sudden heart attack. Unwilling to be passed over again, Tennyson walks into her superior's office and tells him she wants to take over the case.
I know DCI Shefford was at a crucial stage of the investigation.
I have to see his wife this afternoon. Don't expect me to make any decisions now. This is not the right time.
Well, when is the right time? Look, I am the only officer of my rank who has continually overstepped, sidestepped, whatever. Just give me the chance to prove that I can.
You don't have to prove yourself to me. Let me think about it.
Well, that's not enough, Michael. I'm getting sick to death of this so-called Metropolitan Police survey being thrown at me. So, all right, apparently 90% of the time the general public will prefer a male officer. But until one of us gets a chance to prove that that survey is a biased, outdated load of old bullshit...
A close friend, a man who I respected highly, died right there. And now, Inspector, is not the time to thrust your women's rights down my throat. I'll get back to you.
Thank you, sir.
Tennyson finally gets the assignment. What she doesn't get is the cooperation of the men in the department who resent having to answer to a woman. They constantly try to undermine her authority. Helen Mirren got some interesting advice from women inspectors on how to carry herself.
One particular piece of advice which I loved and I'd never thought of before was not to fold your arms. And I had been that morning trying on my costumes and to try and look sort of strong and, you know, butch and in control. I'd been standing there looking at myself in the mirror and folding my arms in a rather sort of what I thought was a rather aggressive sort of stance. And that later on that day, I met with one of my friends in the police force, and she said one of the things we never do is fold our arms. She just mentioned it incidentally. She said because folding your arms is a very defensive gesture, and whereas to be open and to touch, and we touch people a lot because it's a much more powerful and dominating position. And actually, when you look at, say, top politicians, you realize that's what they do. Top people who are truly in power, they don't fold their arms. They stand there open-armed and they touch people a lot. And it's a very animal thing of domination. And that's what the police are very aware of. Men and women, it's not just the women in the police force who are aware of this. The police in general are very aware of body language or and psychology in general.
In Prime Suspect, you look more tired and worn as the story progresses and as you get deeper into the mystery and in more danger of getting thrown off the case. How did you achieve the look of being more tired, more worn? Your eyes become more swollen and it looks like you haven't slept.
I think just the process of working 6 days a week, sort of 15 hours a day, probably achieved it for me. Certainly on the show there, we didn't really use film lighting. We used the kind of neon strip lighting that they have in police stations. You know, a police station is a very physically brutal place to be. It's not very prettified. You know, they don't have nice lighting in England anyway. They don't have nice furniture. Everything is very utilitarian and very brutal. And we simply used that kind of lighting, which obviously is not very flattering. And I liked that. I thought that was of immense value in the piece.
Well, it makes things look more harsh with lighting.
It makes things look more harsh. It also simply makes things look more real.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute you have, the flattering kind of complicated filmic lighting, things actually start looking unreal. So I thought in terms of, and I wanted this to be as real as possible. I think that reality is achieved by that lighting as much as anything.
I have to thank you in a way because there's something very thrilling about seeing, a mature actress playing this kind of role. My fear was that if the series was made in America, it would be, a beautiful actress in her 20s as opposed to, a beautiful actress in her 40s. And you were willing to let your beauty look less beautiful than it really is for the role. Do you know what I mean? I really don't think you let any vanity stand in the way. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, it's really a reverse vanity. It's the vanity of myself as an actress.
Yeah, right.
It's not a physical vanity.
Yes.
It's my vanity of my talent. And so it is another kind of vanity.
Right. No,
that's all.
I understand what you're saying. My guest is actress Helen Mirren, and she stars in a new three-part film that you can see on public television starting tonight. It's called Prime Suspect, and it's being shown as part of the Mystery series on public television. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Helen Mirren, star of the new series Prime Suspect, which is part of the Mystery series on public television. Now, in this role on Prime Suspect, as a detective chief inspector, you play somebody who's very businesslike and very emotionally repressed in a way. And, at work you wear skirted suits. At home, even in bed with your lover, you're too exhausted from work to be sexual. Viewers who only know you from this role might be surprised to know that many of your previous roles were really very sexual. For instance, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have seen you in The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, which was actually an X-rated film when it was released. And it was set in this bizarre restaurant. You were always off in the bathroom or in the kitchen having sex with your lover. Did you have any reservations about taking this role? The film was so controversial in America.
Yes, of course. You know that you're going out on a limb with a piece like that. And in my past, I have not been particularly averse to going out on a limb, although each time you do it, you obviously have reservations about it. You have to think about it. Is it worth it? And I did feel with this film that it was worth it. Peter Greenaway, as you know, is a very, very respected director in England and in Europe in general. And, of course, it wasn't nearly so much of a scandal in Europe as it was here in America.
Do you have to be very comfortable with your body to do sex scenes?
No, not particularly. But there's a funny thing that happens when you're doing a sex scene, is that you get us and them, because there's usually two of you and a whole load of other people, two of you without your clothes on and a load of people with their clothes on. So you become, you actually form this rather, it's sort of a bit like Hansel and Gretel in the woods, you know. You form this little environment between the two of you, and you just tend to cut everyone else out. I have to say that that environment is nothing to do with sex. It's much more to do with kind of friendship and reliance upon each other. And it actually becomes rather a sweet experience, you know, in my experience anyway.
I really loved your performance in Paul Schrader's movie, The Comfort of Strangers. And in this movie, you played opposite Christopher Walken. You were a couple into sadomasochism and voyeurism. Let me play a short clip from the film.
I've never told anyone this. Never. But I want to tell you. Soon after we were married, Robert started to hurt me when we made love. I tried to stop him, but he went on doing it. And after a time, I found I liked it. Not the pain itself, but somehow the fact of being helpless before it, being reduced to nothing by it, and of being punished, therefore being guilty. I felt it was right that I should be punished. I thrilled to it. No, it took us over totally. It grew and grew, it seemed never ending. But there was an end to it. We both knew what it was.
I bet that your work doing soliloquies in classic theater really helped in this part, in doing a little monologue like that.
Yes, that was a very little monologue.
Yeah, I know, but still, it's
yes, I found that role very hard. I must say, of all the film roles I've done, I think that was about the most difficult. I found it, because in a film, much more than in a play in the theatre, you really have to enter into the psychology of the character and live inside that person and look out at the world through their eyes. And I found living inside that person a really uncomfortable place to be.
Almost frightening, I'd imagine.
Yeah, and I... So it was difficult for me, that film. Anyway.
So what did you do to find a way into the character?
Well, I just had to do it, you know. I had to think... I mean, I think that speech is funny. I haven't heard that speech for a long time. Since I did it, I suppose. And this script was written by Harold Pinter, and it was taken from a book by Ian McEwan. And on top of that, you then had Paul Schrader directing it. So there you have three extraordinarily complex psychologies at work. The psychologies of those three men are very deep and dark and complicated. And, you know, that speech is an amazing description of sadomasochism, but also of the sort of strange human desire to be a victim. I don't think that's necessarily women, or, you know, I think it's a universal element in all tribes. You know, that is a universal element in human psychology, the desire to be a victim.
Did you deepen your voice a little bit for the chief inspector role in Prime Suspect?
Yeah, I can't remember. I think maybe I did. Yeah, maybe I consciously did.
Because I was listening back to your performances in The Comfort of Strangers and in The Cook, the Thief. Your voice just seemed deeper to me in Prime Suspect, and maybe even deeper than it does today.
You're right. You know, I'd kind of forgotten. I did it a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
But I think the quality of the voice, anyway, in a role is very important. And I very specifically, I remember in Comfort of Strangers, very specifically used as light and kind of innocent a voice as possible, because I didn't want people at the beginning of the film to immediately identify her as what she ultimately turned out to be. So I wanted there to be this kind of naivete about the character. So I deliberately kind of used a, you know, that sort of voice. And I think probably with Jane Tennyson, yes, I did consciously use a deeper voice, which I think, you know, you can't walk into a police station in a rough part of London and kind of talk like this, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, baby doll voice. You just can't do it.
For a woman in classic theater, are there as many really good roles as there are for the men?
No, of course not. I mean, you don't need to ask me that question. Of course not. There's no King Lears. There's no. I mean, there's a tiny handful of great roles in Shakespeare. Of course, Ibsen on the Scandinavian writers and Russian Chekhov give you quite a good selection of roles, but. No, not in Shakespeare.
I imagine that must be pretty frustrating.
It's incredibly frustrating because you reach, especially in classical theatre, you know, you reach a point of technical. You just reach a point of ability, which takes a long and arduous journey to get there, and you only really get there after 10 or so years of working very, very hard in classical theatre. You understand the nature of the beast, and you get to control it. And the minute you find that you can do it, you turn around and there are not many roles to do it in, you know. Whereas for the men, they reach that point and there are, oh, my God, there's just so many roles for them to play, you know, in Shakespeare anyway.
Where did you grow up in England?
I grew up in a little town, dormitory town, about 40 miles outside of London.
Did you feel that you fit in when you started in the Royal Shakespeare Company? I always like hearing people's stories about what it was like when they started with the company.
Yes, I did. You know, I was lucky in that the whole sense of acting, which used to be in the 40s and 50s and the early 60s, you know, acting was a sort of rather, strangely, because it's not the case at all, but rather an upper-class kind of polite kind of thing to do. And luckily that had broken down by the time I entered the profession because I was neither upper class nor particularly polite. So the whole, you know, late 60s sort of working class English drama suddenly exploded, and people were coming into the theatre with all kinds of different accents. And so I felt very comfortable in that environment. I felt I'd been born to it, and I was where I should be in life.
Helen Mirren stars in the three-part series Prime Suspect. It premieres tonight on the PBS program Mystery. This is Fresh Air. Here's what's coming up on All Things Considered. Ted Clark reports on the United States' decision to airlift more than 50 plane loads of food and medicine to the former Soviet republics. Meanwhile, Ira Glass reports on a decision of homeless advocates in the Midwest to seek aid from foreign countries. Democratic presidential candidate Jerry Brown explains his proposal for a flat income tax rate for all Americans. And we look at what's going on in the Diet, the Japanese equivalent of Congress. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Like New Jack City and Boys in the Hood, when the movie Juice opened last week, it was amid incidents of violence in and around the theaters where it played. But was the movie itself what caused the mayhem? Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see.
The most serious act of violence surrounding Juice was a murder. But the circumstances make it hard to lay the blame on the film. After all, the victim was an innocent bystander killed in the crossfire between two men who were standing in the ticket line for the last showing of the movie. That's right, they hadn't even been in the theater yet. When a picture attracts tough inner-city kids, especially gang members, the violence that sometimes results is no surprise. But you can't condemn a movie for the audience it attracts. Or have we become so frightened by our own impotence that we think that no one should make movies for the so-called underclass? As it turns out, Juice is a clumsy but undeniably chilling cautionary tale. It's about the dangers of underclass peer pressure. And no film in recent years has been more specific and more pointed about the evils of a society that finds itself unable to control the distribution of guns. The juice of the title means power and status. And to the four utterly hapless Harlem high school boys at the movie's center, power and status are the ultimate goal. The movie's hero, Q, played by Omar Epps, hopes to get some juice by becoming a star DJ, but he's the only one of his crew who has an identifiable talent. For his friend Bishop, played by Tupac Shakur, getting some juice means becoming too scary to mess with, and that means becoming a criminal. For Bishop, the first step is to get a gun, which his friend Rahim does with terrible ease. The second step is to rob a neighborhood convenience store. But Q needs some convincing.
We go in, right before 11, get the loot, jet.
The whole thing won't take no longer than 3 minutes.
When did y'all decide this? This morning when I wasn't there?
Yeah, while you was at your appointment.
Check this here, man. I got a DJ Saturday night, you know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to miss that for nobody.
Guess you got a disappointment then.
Maybe not. There's gonna be a lot of DJs there, right?
Yeah.
So how do they pick who goes when?
It was like 40 DJs, 20 sets. All I know is I go 7.
See, because we're going to need an alibi. Since you're going 7, that'll give us an opportunity to go in, do what we got to do, and jet.
Juice isn't exactly unpredictable. The moment a gun appears on the scene, you know someone's going to do something awful with it. And sure enough, Bishop does. But nothing can quite prepare you for the way the gun intoxicates Bishop, transforms him from a sullen kid into a monster willing to commit the neighborhood's cardinal sin, turning on your own gang. The gun is the juice, and once ingested, it acts like a drug. It's as seductive and delusional and savage as crack. First-time director Ernest R. Dickerson has been Spike Lee's cinematographer, and I had always thought the smooth, theatrical, almost candied surface of Lee's films came from him. But Juice looks nothing like a Lee film. It's raw and gritty, so much so that its amateurishness might be downright annoying if it weren't for the vigor of its central performances. All the young actors here look and sound utterly authentic, and not just for Harlem, but for the exasperating, lovelorn world of the teenager. Dickerson shows how these boys' plight is a version of what every adolescent goes through, how the search for juice is universal, except that in these kids' world, the consequences can be dire. Juice is a simple story, simply, even crudely told, but that doesn't make its central theme any less powerful. If those kids going crazy outside the theater manage to make it in and see what's on the screen, they could come out the wiser for it.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the making of Apocalypse Now, we talk with Eleanor Coppola, who filmed behind the scenes while her husband made the Vietnam War epic. Her footage can be seen in the new documentary, Hearts of Darkness. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
This is the end, beautiful friend.